This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Walston, Mundra, Team Up to Form Firm. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle. And along with the article, there are pictures of the two men. We'll discuss them in the article. Don Walston, the boss man of the Triangle's largest residential real estate company, Coldwell banker Howard Perry & Walston, is jumping into the commercial side of the real estate business again. Walston has formed a new business venture with Raleigh real estate developer Sanjay Mundra called HPW Commercial Real Estate, which will at first focus on the sales and marketing of niche property products like hotels, multifamily, and land. But expansion of the business into other commercial sectors could come later, Walston says. Because the economy has changed so much, we are looking for different sources of income, says Walston, the founder and executive chairman of Coldwell banker Howard Perry & Walston. Sanjay and I have been friends for years, and I think the two of us can build something very successful. Back in the mid-1980s, Walston had been an early investor, along with Alton Smith, in a company called Howard Perry & Walston Property Management Company Incorporated, a company that is now known as Trademark Properties and owned by Raleigh real estate executive Billy Redmond. Trademark Properties, which broke away from Howard Perry & Walston in the early 1990s, ranked as the largest commercial real estate brokerage firm in the Triangle in 2012, with 25 licensed brokers on staff, according to Triangle Business Journal's Book of Lists. Walston says he's not trying to take business away from Trademark Properties, which share space in the same Wade Avenue office building as Walston's residential real estate companies. I still support Redmond and will continue to, Walston says. There's plenty of space here for everybody. As for Redmond, she wrote in an email, Don and I have not been partners for almost 20 years. I wish them the best in this new endeavor. Mundra says the real estate company will first focus its attention on hotel, multifamily, and other niche products because those are the areas that Mundra built his career around until the real estate recession took its toll on many of his investments, including the failed Soleil Center Hotel and Condo Tower project near Crabtree Valley Mall. This is nothing different from what I've been doing the last 25 years, just my role has changed from buyer and seller as an owner to a broker, says Mundra, who will serve as chief executive of the new company. And along with this article, there are two boxes that have project principles as the headline with more information on the two gentlemen. First, Sanjay Mundra, age 46, expertise, hotel, restaurant, and multifamily real estate investments. In the Triangle since 1990. Notable projects, Skysail Condominiums and the Sheraton New Bern Hotel and Marina in New Bern. Sheraton Hotel in Charleston. 2013 goal, recruit the best team he can for HPW Commercial Real Estate in the firm's four specialties, including hospitality projects, land development, industrial real estate, and office leasing. Don Walston, age 71, expertise, real estate, and development entrepreneur. In the Triangle since founded Howard Perry & Walston in 1973. Notable projects, HPW Foundation, turnkeys for the Triangle. And we have two more articles on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. These are under a bold line, bold red line that says cover story. And inside of this area, the main headline is Crossroads, Challenges Abound for a Johnston County Bank That Showed So Much Promise. And both of these articles are written by Lee Weisbecker. This first one has the dateline of Four Oaks. When banks stumble, as many have in the wake of the financial meltdown and Great Recession, the general response has been something to the tune of, serves them right. That's not the case with Four Oaks Bank, a 101-year-old company that occupies as big a patch on the community quilt as any other institution in Johnston County. In the midst of Four Oaks' struggles 4 years ago, Johnston leaders didn't turn their backs. No, they collectively anteed up $12 million, money they may or may not see again. There has been no no uprising among the bank's 2,400 shareholders, despite a decision in 2010 by company leaders to quit paying dividends, an annual payment that had been as predictable as Sunrise for 73 prior years. Depositors have not fled Four Oaks. As of June 2012, the bank maintained a dominant 30% deposit market share in the county, bigger than First Citizens, BB&T, PNC, and others. In Wake, it holds a 14th place market share position with nearly 0.6% of deposits. Some of the bank's biggest shareholders sit on the Four Oaks board, and they continue to express confidence in the company's future. It's important, they say. A healthy Four Oaks bank means more capital flowing to businesses and consumers on Wake's Eastern Rim and beyond. I've owned shares in this bank long before I became a director, 1992, and I'm not selling, says board member Warren L. Grimes, 64, director of the Smithfield Housing Authority. Grimes owns nearly 25,000 shares. We believe the bank has made progress, he says. Grimes' belief is echoed by others who are instrumental to the bank's success, including board member Percy Lee, a 71-year-old Clayton Oil Company executive, who along with his wife Joyce was among those pumping $12 million into Four Oaks in May 2009. When asked if a turnaround is in the cards anytime soon, Lee responds, "You tell me. I go to meetings and make decisions, but if you want to talk about the business of the bank, you'll have to call our CEO." Since 2008, Four Oaks Bank has accumulated losses totaling $49 million, $7 million of that coming in 2012. With a plunging share price down by 87% since 2008, the community bank has responded by consolidating or selling off branches to cut costs and manage capital. The loan from bank directors and others came at a time when other banks were taking money from the federal government through the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. Four Oaks' leaders chose not to go that route, but the loan stands as a liability. State and federal regulators, who have had the bank under heightened supervision since May 2011, permitted Four Oaks to repay the interest on those loans last year and may again in 2013 if the money is available. Numbers not adding up. Johnston County born and bred Aiden Lee, 63, has been Four Oaks' CEO since 1980. "The numbers aren't what we want them to be," Lee said in an interview discussing the 2012 results. At the same time, he added, "Four Oaks made progress last year, writing off, selling off, and rehabilitating problem loans and other assets, cutting non-performers by 40%. Loan rehabilitations represented the more positive side of that picture. Some of our customers got well, so to speak, and we were able to move their loans back into the performing category," Lee says. Banking expert and former regulator Don Coker says there is no hard and fast rule as to how long a bank can go on losing money. In the 20 quarters stretching back to the first quarter of 2008, Four Oaks has put up 9 profitable quarters and was unprofitable in 11. The low point came in the fourth quarter of 2010, when losses hit $21.8 million. Often, says Coker, banks under chronic stress find resolution through an intervention from the outside. Another bank makes an offer to buy, or an investor group steps forward with a cash infusion. What Coker considers an ill-advised move is for a troubled bank to opt for the short-term fix of selling profitable branches and their loans and deposits. Such moves may help a bank bring its risk assets into better balance with its reserves, but at the same time, revenue generators are being given up. "It's like selling off the furniture," he says. Lee, who sold off Four Oaks' Rockingham and Southern Pines branches to Troy-based First Bank, admits it was a move he didn't particularly want to make. "But when you have limited capital, you have to manage it," he says. "It's not something you want to do, but it's something that makes sense." What he may have lost in branches, Lee has worked to hold on to as far as the bank's human capital is concerned. At 206 employees back in December 2009, the current count is 197, according to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Four Oaks continued to be classified as well capitalized under regulatory guidelines as of December 31. Searching for cash. Going forward, the bank continues looking into various options to raise capital, but Lee says he can't comment on the matter. I'm guarded as to what I can say, he says. We spent last year cleaning the balance sheet, and I think we did a pretty good job, and we expect to see our asset quality continue to improve. With $36 million in non-repaying, mostly real estate, loans still on the books, a big job remains to be done, and Four Oaks continues to show the signs of strain. Its current Texas score is 164, according to Lee Burrows of Atlanta-based Bank Street Partners, and that's not good. Texas score is a ratio measure that divides a bank's non-performing assets by its shareholder equity plus reserves. A score of 50 or less is considered good. A number approaching 90 or topping 100 is considered a warning sign about the health of the institution. As for Lee, he's holding the course. All things come with time, he says of his bank's turnaround. You ask when? Tell me when interest rates will begin moving up and when unemployment in Johnston County and other places will begin to drop. You tell me that, and I'll give you a better idea on the time. And now the second article in the cover story section of the Triangle Business Journal has the headline, Community Banks Mend Across North Carolina, also written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. With profitability stable or up and problem loans heading down, the North Carolina banking industry is well on the mend. In 2012, some 20.3% of 74 state-chartered, mostly community banks were unprofitable, compared to 35% in that condition in 2011, according to the North Carolina Office of the Commission of Banks. Mergers and one bank failure, that of Whiteville-based Waccamaw Bank, contributed to that 15% swing toward a more favorable direction, but the more significant driver was better banking conditions. While economic difficulties continue, most institutions are well capitalized and remain viable, says interim state banking commissioner Ray Grace. In North Carolina, five community banks currently have Texas scores above 100. That's a measure of portfolio stress, with a score of 50 considered good, and anything approaching or above 100 considered a warning sign. In addition to Johnston County-based Four Oaks, the state's 100-plus banks are First Financial Services Corporation, Hendersonville, Texas score of 304.6, FNB United Corporation, Asheboro, 147, AB&T Financial Corporation, Gastonia, 142, and Parkway Bank, Lenore, 265. The figures were supplied by Atlanta-based Bank Street Partners using data compiled by Charlottesville, Virginia-based SNL Financial. Getting better, but with scattered problems, I think that's a fair assessment of the state of the industry, says bank expert and former industry regulator Don Coker. It's an old saw at this point that the nation's mega banks, such as Charlotte-based Bank of America, emerged from the meltdown of 2008 more rapidly than the community banks, many of which had large concentrations of real estate-related loans and subsequent losses. However, some community banks, defined in one measure as having assets of $1 billion or less, found themselves totaling up fewer problem loans than others. It is now those players with stronger capital bases or new investors that are taking the lead in a new acquisition expansion phase in the industry. Raleigh-based Vantage South, one of four North Carolina banks to post 30% total asset growth in 2012, has just completed its acquisition of $900 million East Carolina Bank on the coast. Jim Beck's Trust Atlantic is buying branch offices in a Wake County expansion. Also making moves has been Raleigh-based Capstone Bank, which has entered the Cary and Fuquay-Varina markets by office openings or acquisition. The bank's next step will be a listing on the over-the-counter bulletin board market, becoming one of the Triangle's newest publicly traded firms. Its ticker, CPSE, already has a spot on the exchange, but formal trading has yet to begin. Attempts to reach Capstone CEO Mike Patterson for comment were not successful. This is going to give the bank added visibility, Raymond James investment banker Bill Wagner says of the listing. And now we turn to the biz column in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline that starts it off, of all who ask, fewer than 10% get into Duke. What are the chances an applicant to Duke University will be accepted? This year, it's 9.9%. That's the percentage of the 29,200 regular decision applicants who were accepted into Duke's class of 2017. Those 2,897 admissions represent what Duke officials characterize as the most competitive cycle to date. Including early decision applicants, Duke received 31,785 requests for admission. From what I've seen, this is the best class ever in some ways, but it's still a class that we all recognize as very Duke. Steve Nowicki, Dean and Vice Provost of Undergraduate Education, told the Duke Chronicle, "Very Duke? Ah, baseball, it's back. As American as apple pie, hot dogs, and beer. Yes, beer. Ballparks across the country over the past few years have begun offering more than the standard taps of old. As for our local minor league parks, the Class A Carolina Mudcats this year will be serving up brews from Natty Greens in Raleigh. At the Durham Bulls Athletic Park, pours will come from Carolina Brewery, Natty Greens, Foothills Brewing, and Oscar Blues. Bulls fans take note, this is the 25th anniversary of the filming of the classic movie Bull Durham at the old Durham Athletic Park, as well as in and around Durham, and the ball club is not forgetting. Planned are in-game features and themed merchandise. For every Sunday home game, the players will wear throwback jerseys. Entrepreneurs, don't get an MBA. That's the latest advice from startup guru and former Durham resident Vivek Wadhwa in a column published in the Wall Street Journal, in which he also discourages entrepreneurs from hiring MBAs. That's because I've seen a growing mismatch between the skills the business schools teach and what fast-paced startups require, he writes. And corporate management isn't the best way to entrepreneurship anyway. The best way is to work for a startup. He adds that most business schools are geared toward churning out investment bankers, not producing entrepreneurs. Maybe Wadhwa should do what Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal, did a couple of years ago. He urged the under-20 crowd to ditch college and start a business. He even offered to pay $100,000 through his fellowship program. Wadhwa, in case you're curious, has an MBA from NYU. Burlingame, California-based Tecmo Koei Games is joining the pool of companies to license Cary-based Epic Games' Unreal Engine 3 technology. The company is using the software to develop a new take on the Ninja Gaiden franchise with Yaiba Ninja Gaiden Z. The agreement was brokered by Epic Games Japan, and the new game is currently in development. Tecmo is the American subsidiary of Japanese firm Tecmo Koei Holdings and has several titles in its repertoire, including Dead or Alive and Fatal Frame. Epic created the Gears of War and Infinity Blade franchises. Epic is currently strutting its stuff at the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco. Durham loves trees. No, really. The city has been recognized as a Tree City USA for the 30th consecutive year. It's a designation that was granted during the city's annual Arbor Day celebration, March 22, which happened at the Black Wall Street Plaza downtown. Bull City loves trees so much that city officials had a seed giveaway at the event. The plaza, landscaped with the $40,500 that remains of a grant and a $10,000 donation from BP and Family Fair, is part of the Parish Street Project. For the record, there's a long list of North Carolina cities and towns that have Tree City USA designation. Social media startup Avelist, spelled A-V-E-L-I-S-T, is readying for its nationwide launch, says CEO Jody Porowski. We just launched our mobile apps, she says, adding that she has left her day job at SAS and is listing full-time. Listing? Basically, that's what it is, she says. She explains, starting with how she came up with the Avelist concept. When I first got this idea, I was sitting at work at SAS, and I was just thinking that I had a couple of friends who were getting married, and they didn't know each other, but they were all making lists of wedding venues and photographers and caterers, she recalls. I realized they were all making the exact same list. She thought about introducing them to each other, but realized it wasn't just these three women. It's people planning weddings all over Raleigh that could benefit from this list. That was about 2 years ago. Now that idea has become a refined concept in which people can make lists of anything, public lists, like favorite Raleigh restaurants, and private lists, like for shopping. Campbell University will forever have alum and baseball Cy Young Award winner Jim Perry's name etched in stone. From here on out, March 26 will be known in Buies Creek as Jim Perry Day, and the university officially dedicated the refurbished baseball stadium to Perry, class of 1959, on that date last month. It's like making the major leagues, Perry said of the decision of Jim Perry Stadium. I didn't know many years ago when I came to Campbell that this was going to happen. It's a fantastic day. After leaving the Fighting Camels, Perry went on to pitch for 17 years in the major leagues and won the 1970 Cy Young Award when he was with the Minnesota Twins. Renovations on Jim Perry Stadium began in 2011. Upgrades include a new entrance gate and ticket booth, restroom and concession facility, and exterior wrought iron fencing, as well as improved exterior landscaping. Leslie Rutherford, wife of Carolina Hurricanes general manager Jim Rutherford, finds herself quite busy these days. This community gives us so much, she says. I want to find ways to give back in a meaningful and consistent way. So, with assistance from DPAC's Thorne Daubenspeck, Leslie is helping out the Duke Home and Hospice folks in Durham with the Helping Hands charity event on April 28, featuring the folk rock band Delta Ray. It has been a wonderful experience, and I hope to work with different charities in the coming years, she says. The private event is at the Lincoln Theater in Raleigh. Spike TV was in Garner a week ago to film an episode of the show Bar Rescue, in which host John Taffer and crew take on a failing bar, spiff it up, help management figure out their issues, and reopen, generally with a new menu and name. Such was the case at a bar along US 70 in Garner called Characters Quarters. Now called Moon Runner Saloon, the bar reopened on March 31, and the owners blogged, "This has truly been a rewarding experience." Contributing to Biz were staffers Lauren Onsorge, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, and Jason DeBrun. And now we turn to the full-length stories in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to, Bond Traders Launch in Raleigh. This one's written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. The financial services industry may still be in flux. Interest rates may be at historic lows, with speculation abounding about when they'll start going up. But don't expect any of that to deter Melissa J. Pendergrass. Along with a trio of partners, she has launched a company, Falcon Square Capital, FSC, to buy and sell bonds across various fixed income markets for institutional clients. And in launching their ship, the FSC Four are bucking a trend in the broker-dealer industry. The new firm's paper license from the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA, is literally being framed to hang in a spot in the firm's North Raleigh office. And Pendergrass has hit the ground running. We think we've made a good decision, she says. This is something we've been wanting to do for a long time. FSC is not a retail operation, neither is it a wealth advisory company in the fixed income sector. Its clients instead are wealth management companies, banks, pension funds, institutions that hold large bond portfolios, and that need a broker-dealer to do the buying and selling. Falcon executes the trades for a fee and doesn't offer opinions about the advisability of this or that particular trade. And when Pendergrass and her partners aren't out drumming up customers, they're sitting in front of Bloomberg terminals making those trades. Since 2008, FINRA registered firms have declined in number by 13% to 4,276, and the number of representatives by 5% to 629,982. FINRA spokesman George Smaragatis blamed the declines on the financial shakeout from 2008 and a number of factors, including mergers, consolidations. The principals making up FSE, average age 30, were just graduating, were still in class, or were new recruits to the financial services industry when the meltdown happened back in 2008 and have matured in its aftermath. Joining Pendergrass, who obtained an MBA from UNC Chapel Hill at Falcon Square are Scott Cunningham, Vanderbilt, 2006, Braxton Wall, UNC Chapel Hill, 2008, and Keaton Wright, Bucknell, 2009. They met while working between 2007 and 2013 at Chapel Hill-based Carolina Capital Markets, a broker-dealer operation set up in 1994 by Tom Shugrue. There, they focused on fixed income markets. The biggest unknown in bond markets these days is when the Federal Reserve will reverse its present course and begin allowing interest rates to rise, a move that would also work to cut bond prices. Investment advisors such as Charles Leedy of Chapel Hill have been trying to decipher the Fed's intentions for months and recommending that clients, if they buy corporate or other types of bonds, invest in ones with short maturities in anticipation of the Fed's next move. Those maturing in 2 or 3 years, he says, we are certainly not recommending long-term. Pendergrass says some of Falcon Square's clients have been seeking help in doing just that, and we assist them in restructuring their holdings, she says. Growth plans being laid for BASF in RTP. That's the headline on our next article, this one written by Amanda Jones-Hoyle, with a Dateline of Research Triangle Park. German chemical giant BASF, which moved the headquarters of its plant science division to the Triangle in 2012, is already planting seeds for growth in the region. BASF, with help from Kling Stubbins' design firm in Raleigh, has drafted plans to build a nearly 150,000-square-foot office building on the company's 126-acre campus in Research Triangle Park. That's enough space to accommodate as many as 400 employees. The company now employs 760 in the Triangle. The project would be in addition to a $33 million laboratory and greenhouse facility that is under construction in RTP and is expected to open this fall. Fran Castle, a representative of BASF Plant Science, says the plans for the new office building, known as the G-Wing Edition, are for now an exploratory proposal. They were filed recently with the Durham City County Planning Department. We're getting preliminary information from Durham as if certain expansions were going to happen, Castle says. It's not unusual to do that several years ahead of when it could occur. BASF in 2012 and in early 2013 relocated about 150 jobs from office and research sites in Europe and in the U.S. to its facilities in RTP. Morrisville and Durham, as the company has focused more on its capital resources in North Carolina. In another move, it relocated 140 jobs from Europe to the Triangle last year when the company decided to move the headquarters for its plant science division to RTP, citing a lack of acceptance in Europe for its genetically modified crop products among consumers, farmers, and politicians. The company moved about 30 more jobs from the St. Louis region when it consolidated its pest control, turf, and vegetation management division into one specialty products department based in the Triangle. Besides the current employee roster of 760 full-timers, BASF works with another 140 consultants, Castle says. In addition to the company's research campus on Davis Drive in RTP, BASF leases office space in one of Lenovo's buildings at Perimeter Park in Morrisville, as well as office space in the Meridian Corporate Park in Durham, where most of BASF Plant Sciences headquarters staff is based. Over the last few years, the Triangle has become a hub for companies like BASF that are doing research in plant biotechnology and pest control for crops. The headquarters for Bayer Crop Science is in RTP, as is the biotechnology division for Switzerland-based Syngenta. Monsanto and DuPont Pioneer also have research facilities in the state. Bayer Crop Science is working on a new master plan for its facilities in the Triangle, sources say, including plans to renovate its buildings in RTP. Bayer Crop Science in January leased an 82,000-square-foot laboratory building in Durham that will be used as flex space while the corporate buildings are under construction. It also acquired nearly 70 acres of land in RTP for future expansion. The company employs about 640 people in the Triangle. Bayer Crop Science spokeswoman Becca Hogan would not provide more detail about the company's future expansion plans. Meanwhile, Syngenta is moving researchers into a $71 million greenhouse built in RTP, a move that is expected to be complete in May. Syngenta, like BASF, has filed preliminary expansion plans for its campus in RTP. The company in September submitted revisions to its site plan at 9 Davis Drive that would allow construction of a nearly 200,000-square-foot building with administrative office space and research laboratories. Syngenta employs about 400 people in the Triangle. And now we turn to A Better World, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities in the Triangle Business Journal. First, we have the column by Todd Cohen, the headline on the column, "For 30 years, helping homeless in Durham find the help they need." Formed in 1992 to prevent and end homelessness through increased access to health care, housing, and integrated services, Housing for New Hope in Durham serves more than 1,000 individuals and families a year. It connects homeless people to services they need, provides or connects them to permanent housing, and support services to help them stay housed and owns and operates 90 housing units it has developed. And since 2010, spurred by funding from the federal stimulus package designed to reboot the collapsed economy, the agency has partnered with three Durham agencies that provide emergency and transitional housing, and with a growing coalition of public and private partners and funders to operate a rapid rehousing program designed to help households move themselves out of poverty. "We don't necessarily end their poverty," says Terry Alabaugh, executive director of Housing for New Hope. "We help them to end their homelessness, which puts them on a path where they have a better chance of ending their poverty. A home provides a stable base to work from. We want to provide access to services to assist folks to increase their income." Starting with the first federal grant it received in 1992, the agency has worked to form public-private partnerships and funding opportunities. And in recent years, Alabaugh says, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has encouraged community collaboration to address homelessness. With $1 million from the federal stimulus package, Housing for New Hope, in partnership with Urban Ministries of Durham, Genesis Home, and the Durham Interfaith Hospitality Network, has served 173 households through its rapid rehousing program. Now, with that federal funding gone, the four agencies have secured a total of $450,000 from the Stewards Fund and from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, both in Raleigh, and from the City of Durham, that will allow them to continue and improve the program, serving at least 80 households over the next year. The new effort, like the one it replaces, is rooted in collaboration and allows for more flexibility than was permitted under the stimulus funding, Alabaugh says. The Raleigh-based Interfaith Food Shuttle and Food Bank of Eastern and Central North Carolina, for example, will provide each household with 50 pounds of food to get them started. A handful of Durham congregations and civic groups will provide housewarming baskets that include cleaning supplies and other household items, while the Green Chair Project in Raleigh will provide households with furnishings. Durham Technical Community College and the Office of Economic and Workforce Development for the City of Durham will provide households with job readiness training and job placement services, including classes to be held at Urban Ministries and attended by its clients and those of Genesis Home and the Durham Interfaith Hospitality Network. And Circle of Support, teams of 5 to 7 volunteers recruited by Genesis Home, will provide support for families for a year. "One agency operating by itself could not do this," Alabaugh says. "You want to support each other to be even more successful." Nonprofit news. A private donor has given $100,000 to the Partnership to Build a Miracle of Johnston County. The partnership is committed to raising $1.5 million to build a Miracle League baseball field and special needs park. The complex will allow the more than 4,000 special needs children in Johnston County and surrounding areas to play without having to worry about accessibility. It also will serve all children and seniors who often also have mobility issues. The Veterans Leadership Council of North Carolina has been awarded a grant of $2,000 by the CBCWRAL Community Fund of the Triangle Community Foundation. VLC Executive Director Captain John W. Turner says, other organizations that have made recent grants or donations to the VLC include RAI, Time Warner, Green Beret Foundation, and Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina. The Ray Price Harley-Davidson Brunswick Stew Cook-Off raised $2,180 for the Pediatric Brain Tumor Foundation. We're thrilled to support the children and families helped by the Pediatric Brain Tumor Foundation, says Chris Weiss, Director of Marketing and Promotions, Ray Price Harley-Davidson. And now the People on the Move section. Former Durham Mayor Nick Tennyson and Chapel Hill Business Executive Matt Springer joined the Board of Directors of Triangle Residential Options for Substance Abusers Incorporated. As board members, Tennyson and Springer will help set policy and direction for TROSA, a residential treatment program for people working to overcome drug and alcohol abuse. Our next article in the Triangle Business Journal is written by Jesse Burkhart with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, TBJ poll results, build the Dix Park already. What should become of the 325-acre Dorothea Dix property? That's the hot-button question that has both Raleigh residents and state legislators buzzing. A controversy centers around a 99-year lease signed by former Governor Beverly Perdue and the City of Raleigh, stipulating the city pay $500,000 a year for the Dix property so it can be turned into a destination park. Those who oppose the lease say the terms don't favor the state and that the deal would ultimately cost taxpayers money because State Department of Health and Human Services offices at the site would have to be removed. Supporters of the deal point to the job creation potential a major park holds, while saying a decision to revoke the lease would reflect poorly on the state. Already, a bill to revoke the lease has been approved by the state Senate and is now being deliberated by the House. The state Senate's decision, however, is not embraced by Triangle Business Journal readers, who overwhelmingly believe the lease should be honored. And now we'll read the pages in the Triangle Business Journal that are sectioned off by topic and reporter. First, we have Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and real estate and residential real estate. The first article, Brothers Spin Company Out of Software, with the Dateline of Raleigh. When Chapel Hill real estate broker Rich Harris was putting together a plan to start his own commercial real estate firm in 2008, he wanted an easier way to keep track of his pipeline of deals and to track the success rate the brokers he would hire. So he enlisted the help of his oldest brother, Dave Harris, to create a cloud-based software program nearly from scratch that would integrate client documents, provide key metrics for business planning, and generate invoices. We both have a lot of experience in commercial real estate and in technology, says Rich Harris, now managing director of Synergy Commercial Advisors of Mooresville, but we never intended on creating another company. After 2 years of planning, though, Dave Harris is now spending most of his time on the road pitching their software platform called Real Core Applications to commercial real estate firms across the country. Dave Harris describes Real Core's software platform as having many of the same client tracking functions as Salesforce, the social media aspects of Facebook, and the business reporting functions of QuickBooks, but integrated with all the accounting quirks of a commercial real estate brokerage firm. Real Core raised about $350,000 in angel funding in October 2010 to get started, and the group has recently raised another $350,000 from angel investors to spend on sales and marketing. Its seven-member board of directors includes Texas real estate veteran Ken Sandstad, real estate consultant Rod Santamassimo, and Duke Realty senior vice president Jeff Sheehan. Dave Harris estimates they have about 100 users on the system already, which includes the 11 commercial brokers at Synergy Commercial Advisors. The truth is most brokers speak a different language than managers, Dave Harris says. Most brokers are not CFO-minded. Most are more like John Belushi types, in reference to the late comedy actor who starred in Animal House. John Carr, president of York Properties Commercial Division based in Raleigh, says his firm has been using Realcore since January and is pleased with the results. It's a good tool for a broker to capture all of what's going on in his business, Carr says. NAI Carroll Atlantic Realty in Raleigh also is incorporating Realcore into its systems, Harris says. Cardinal Adult Living back on go at North Hills. After several years of stop-and-go action, the new developer of the Cardinal at North Hills Continuing Care Retirement Community is ready to break ground and has opened a model and sales office at North Hills. Already, about 140 of the 160 independent living apartment units have been reserved by potential tenants, says Bob Ogle, Vice President of Sales and Marketing for the property's management team. Kisco Senior Living. The Cardinal also will have 60 apartments licensed for assisted living, memory care, and nursing care. The first units are expected to open in 2015. The project was originally envisioned with for-sale condo units, but the business plan has since been changed to offer for-rent apartment units instead for adults ages 55 and older. The Cardinal's new Discovery Center sales office, complete with a model of one of the 10 floor plans available, has opened in a space adjacent to Zoe's Kitchen in the Park and Market building across from the CapTrust Tower on Six Forks Road. And now we have Chris Bagley's section. Bagley covers transportation, law, and energy. The headline, Fewer Civil Rights Claims Being Filed. And this article has a dateline of Raleigh. Employers are facing fewer civil rights lawsuits than they did several years ago, as a slowly strengthening job market combines with several long-term trends in the workplace and the courts. Race discrimination lawsuits in particular are becoming less common, a trend that has continued for a generation, both nationally and in North Carolina, according to attorneys for employees and employers alike. But sexual harassment and several other types of alleged discrimination persist, and employees' attorneys say any decline in the numbers merely reflects a series of federal court decisions that have made it harder to get cases before a jury and limits the amount that plaintiffs can recover. Discrimination can take the form of firing, demoting, or failing to promote a qualified employee. Most everyone agrees that recent economic growth, while modest, has led employers to fire fewer workers and that fewer are suing under the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, gender, and religion. Researchers at Syracuse University say the numbers of cases have fallen for the last 2 years, including a 13% decline between February 2012 and February 2013. The numbers have also been edging downward in the two branches of federal court that cover the Triangle and the Triad. About 160 local employees sued under the Civil Rights Act in each of the last 2 years, down from more than 180 in 2009 and 2010, according to court statistics. But race may be the only category in which fewer employees are complaining. Gender discrimination and sexual harassment are still common in information technology and other heavily male industry sectors, says Faith Herndon, a Durham attorney who represents employees. That view squares with statistics from the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, where employees must check in before suing. The agency registered more charges, employee complaints, in the last 3 years than in any 3-year period in at least 15 years. Those trends run parallel in North Carolina and nationally, the EEOC says. The agency investigates the complaints and in about 4% of the cases finds compelling evidence of a violation, which the employee can then cite in a lawsuit. The agency itself follows up with a lawsuit in a smaller handful of cases. Those numbers have fallen in the last couple of years, partly due to budget cuts. Reuben Daniels, director for the EEOC's Charlotte District, says those declines reflect a focus on systemic and company-wide cases where the agency can pursue a complaint on behalf of more employees. Employers in North Carolina and 5 other southeastern states have benefited from favorable rulings by the federal Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, attorneys for both employers and employees say. That court has been particularly aggressive in enforcing procedural steps that plaintiffs have to take in employment cases, attorneys say. But a company with aggrieved employees in multiple judicial districts can be sued in any one of those districts. The bar for lawsuits is being raised in other districts too, though, attorneys say. That has led many plaintiff-side attorneys to focus less on Civil Rights Act cases and more on other types of employment cases, says Amy Carmack, a partner with the Morningstar Law Group in South Durham who represents employers. Randy Avram, an employer-side attorney with Kilpatrick Stockton in Raleigh, says he's getting more cases where clients are accused of misclassifying employees as salaried in order to avoid paying overtime. There are so many employers that don't understand the wage and hour laws, he says. And now we have Lauren Onsorge's section. Onsorge covers biotechnology, technology, and Durham. The headline, Building a Business Out of a Dorm-Born Creation, with the Dateline of Raleigh. The scene is 2010 in a quiet dorm room at North Carolina State University. That's where, armed with scotch tape and a lot of trash, then-sophomore Mark Delgado did something he seems to think is no big deal. He created a nuclear radiation detector. "Yes, I did do that," he says. While some college students choose less worthy pursuits, Delgado, a nuclear engineering student, decided that making a detector with information gleaned from videos and internet searches would be a productive use of his time. "I made it out of copper pipe that I found," he says. "I couldn't solder the wires to the copper pipe, so I taped them. It was a complete and total hack." Delgado, who placed second at the recent 2013 Startup Madness competition at NC State, had decided he wanted to start a nuclear radiation detector business, and if I was going to have a radiation detector business, I needed to know how to make one. That led to a company he's calling Koyr, K-O-Y-R, one that he hopes will soon be producing both detectors and software to monitor radiation levels at facilities such as power plants and airports. Who we directly compete with are 1960s radiation detectors that are still based on analog, he says. His detectors are wireless and work with Android phones. Delgado hopes to graduate in May and be able to devote himself full-time to the business. He'd like to do that in Raleigh, but there could be a kink. Despite raising more than $30,000 in grants and prizes, Koyr may need more money at some point, and Delgado doesn't know if he can find it here. "I was in Boston during spring break just networking and trying to meet investors, and a lot of them said they don't invest outside of New England," he says. "Apparently it's the same in Silicon Valley. So if venture capital beckons, he'll go elsewhere. But I'd like to stay in Raleigh," he says. Finding capital is a vexing issue for startups. Southern Capital's Jason Kaplan says he hears about a lot of startups looking for cash, but he's encouraged by a recent proliferation of accelerators such as Launch Chapel Hill and co-working space Hub Raleigh. "I think it's a great thing," he says. "We're seeing a lot more startup activity, and we've been seeing an accelerated number of startups in the area. Events like Startup Madness help further encourage that spirit. It's healthy for the market," Kaplan says. And the spotlight in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal is on sports business. The first article, Lousy Weather Costly for Golf Courses. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. The chilly weather so far this year has not only caused people to curse the sky, it's also belting the top lines of golf courses. Courses across the state have been open for play 17% fewer days on average this year compared to 2012, and that has resulted in a 13% decline in golf-related revenue. "This time of year, we are at the mercy of Mother Nature," says Brian Kidler, Vice President of Golf Operations at McConnell Golf. "This time last year, most of our clubs were already mowing fairways. This year, we are all waiting for the Bermuda to start growing in the fairways." The same is true in nearly every course, and it's really no surprise. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which has an office on Centennial Campus in Raleigh, the average temperature in March this year was 44.7 degrees Fahrenheit. By comparison, the average temperature for March of last year was more than 16 degrees warmer on average, according to data compiled by Darren Figursky, a NOAA meteorologist. Take Crossdale Country Club in Durham as just one example. The club recorded 700 fewer golf rounds played so far this year, down about 20% compared with 2012. It was the wettest quarter I've seen in my 5 years here at Crossdale, and it definitely had an effect on rounds played, says General Manager Steve Cornelison. That golf rounds played increase or decrease with weather conditions is not a surprise, but 2012 and 2013 serve as an interesting juxtaposition because March 2012 was one of the warmest in history, and March this year was one of the coldest at 7.4 degrees below normal. Courses around the nation are feeling the same pinch as here in North Carolina. Nationwide, courses have been open 14% fewer days so far this year compared to last year, and total rounds played are down 10%, according to PGA Performance Track, a service that tracks the golf course industry and works in conjunction with the National Golf Course Owners Association. The only silver lining in the clouds was that food and beverage revenue was actually up this year compared to 2012, as members of private clubs were perhaps choosing to spend time at the restaurant or bar instead of the golf course. Choosing to focus on the bright side, Kidler points out that there is likely a lot of pent-up demand for golf. With the Masters and warmer weather right around the corner, I'm positive we will see rounds of golf pick up in the coming week, he says. And a second article in this section, As Losses Mount, Gate Suffers, also written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. As the Carolina Hurricanes continue to rack up losses, fans seem more likely to stay at home rather than going to cheer on the team at PNC Arena. Through the first nine home games, the Canes posted a record of 9-6 and enjoyed a spot atop the division. The team even enjoyed a four-game winning streak at one point. In those nine games, average attendance was a strong 18,403 per game, and the team announced six capacity crowds of 18,680. It wouldn't last, however. In the past 10 games, the Canes have gotten only one win and dropped to third in the division and out of a playoff spot. As losses have piled up, crowds have dwindled. In the past eight home games, attendance was an average of 16,698 per game, a 9% decrease from the winning days, and the only sellout came on a Saturday when crowds tend to be higher. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Should Court Take Case, OR Ruling Could Be Profound. Two losers in a battle for operating rooms have petitioned the North Carolina Supreme Court to hear their case, and should the court do so, the outcome could affect every North Carolina taxpayer, particularly as Medicaid reform takes shape. At stake is permission from regulators to open three operating rooms in Wake County, and Wake Med Health and Hospitals, Rex Healthcare, Duke Raleigh, and Novant Health want them all. At first blush, it may not sound like the kind of case that would drive major hospital systems to the state's highest court, but ORs can be major money makers for hospitals, which is why they are taking off the gloves and duking this one out. Consider that in Wake County, 68% of the 105,196 outpatient surgery cases in 2009 were for patients with commercial insurance. That's not only well above the percentage for all cases a hospital handles, but it's also above the 50% statewide average for outpatient cases. It's important because hospitals typically receive the highest reimbursement for any procedure from patients with commercial insurance, meaning such patients provide a higher operating margin than any other patient. Take Wake Med as an example. In the first year of operation of the three ORs, should it get them, Wake Med projected a net income of $7.2 million on net revenue of $61 million. That is projected to increase to net income of $10.4 million on net revenue of $73 million by year three. That 14% profit margin is well above the 3.5% profit margin it recorded system-wide last year. Wake Med, Duke Raleigh, Rex, and Novant, which is based in Winston-Salem, all applied for the operating rooms in March 2010, with the proposed investments ranging from about $6 million to about $9 million. Hospitals must apply with the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services before adding services, and in this case, DHHS was going to award the operating rooms only to one provider. And on July 28, 2010, DHHS awarded the rooms to Novant, which applied under the name Holly Springs Surgery Center, the name it would give a surgery center it planned to build in Holly Springs. This ruling set in motion various appeals, including a May 17, 2011 decision by Administrative Law Judge Donald Overby that reversed the initial ruling and awarded Wake Med the rooms, an August 31, 2011 final decision by DHHS, which awarded the rooms back to Novant, and a September 4, 2012 ruling by the North Carolina Court of Appeals that upheld the DHHS ruling and kept the rooms with Novant. That final ruling led Wake Med and Rex to petition the Supreme Court to hear the case. Duke Raleigh voluntarily dismissed its petition. Wake Med CEO Bill Atkinson says the decision to push this fight is about dollars and cents. The Holly Springs Surgical Center would operate close to Wake Med Cary, and Atkinson says it would take patients away from his hospital. That would leave Wake Med Cary with fewer outpatient surgery cases, those being the bill-paying kind, but the same amount of emergency room, Medicaid, or charity case patients, those being the patients with a higher likelihood of not paying the full hospital bill. You have to have a balance of how care is provided, Atkinson says. You can't have a provider that can siphon off the paying patients and leave everything else for a system like Wake Med. With Medicaid on the mind because of Governor Pat McCrory's plan to reform the $14 billion program, Atkinson says that allowing Novant to add the surgery center would only come back to cost the state. The taxpayers need to understand that this is going to come back to them in the form of a massive subsidy, he says. Novant argues economics, saying its entry into the market would represent another option for patients here. We argue that competition is a good thing, says Noah Huffstedler, a partner with Nelson Mullins, law firm in Raleigh, who represents Novant. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.